From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, massacre in Oregon. Russia bombs in Syria, Planned Parenthood grilled, the Pope and Kim Davis. 10 dead, 7 wounded in a shooting at a community college in Roseburg, Oregon yesterday. Here's police radio as events unfolded.
Gunshots right now with the Malleys in the classroom on the southeast side of Snyder Hall.
Dispatch as many ambulances as possible to this incident. We have upwards of 20 victims.
The U.S. looks blindsided as Russian jets bomb in Syria. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow is targeting terrorists.
If it looks like a terrorist, if it acts like a terrorist, if it walks like a terrorist, if it fights like a terrorist, it's a terrorist, right?
And Planned Parenthood CEO Cecile Richards grilled at a congressional hearing.
Do you defend the sale of baby body parts?
No. And I think that is really a total mischaracterization.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, Michael Crowley of Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Another mass shooting in the United States. Where do we go from here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington, Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Tom, and thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. And from Washington, Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Michael, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you. Hello, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and Michael.
The president last night after news of the shooting.
Somehow this has become routine. The reporting is routine. My response here at this podium ends up being routine. The conversation in the aftermath of it, we've become numb to this.
Umpqua Community College, 9 killed, shooter dead, that makes 10, 7 wounded, and the nation just watching again. The president saying again last night, thoughts and prayers, not enough.
Our thoughts and prayers are not enough. It's not enough. It does not capture the heartache and grief and anger that we should feel. And it does nothing to prevent this carnage from being inflicted someplace else in America. Next week, or a couple of months from now.
Nancy Cordes, the president essentially saying Americans get busy politically. We can't go on meeting like this in this circumstance, talking about another mass shooting like this. We need something to happen. You've been reporting on Capitol Hill. Is there anything stirring that would change the gun status quo in the United States in Washington?
Not at all, Tom, at least not at this point, despite the president saying yesterday that while he'll be accused of politicizing the issue, that the issue should be politicized and that, the U.S. takes action when people are killed in other ways because of natural disasters or terrorism. We make changes to policy. And why is it that in this particular area, nothing can ever be done? But the last time that Congress really debated actually strengthening gun laws was 2013, after the Sandy Hook Elementary shootings, where you'll remember 20 children and 6 adults were killed. It really shocked the nation. And so Congress did debate a legislation that would have increased punishment for gun trafficking. It would have expanded background checks, something that 88% of Americans say they support. But the support was not there in Congress. Almost all Republicans and some Democrats were against it. It did not make it through the Senate, which was controlled by Democrats at the time. It's no longer controlled by Democrats, which means that it's very unlikely that any kind of gun legislation is going to come back again.
Michael Crowley, you cover the world. The president making a point again that the United States is alone among advanced nations in not having more controls on the easy availability of guns. Does anybody else have a problem like this? I mean, the numbers that we're seeing now, 45th shooting at a school or college in the United States so far this year. And then mass shootings this year, the numbers vary from 240-something to 260-something, up around 250. Are we alone with this kind of epidemic of mass shooting, school shooting, Michael?
We are. And not only are we alone, but this comes up all the time when you talk to people from other countries. They, you know, it's like this freakish aspect of American life that
what is up
viewed
with you
around
guys?
The world. What is up with you guys? And your country is terrifying. And I think there are people who, you know, may be afraid to visit here. The statistical odds of being caught up in a shooting like this are small, but the headlines amplify the effect. And it just makes America seem like a kind of crazy, lawless, dangerous place. And, you know, countries that are hostile to us really play this up. You know, America kind of, we often lecture the world, and sometimes we are seen as being the world's policeman and all that. And for instance, if you look at Moscow media outlets this week, which I've been reading closely for reasons we'll discuss in a couple minutes, you know, they've given quite a lot of attention to this. Look at what's happening in America. That country is really screwed up, but they're pointing the finger at everyone else.
Jack, I mean, those two things linked up this week. In a way, we didn't know there would be another mass shooting, but there was the president at the United Nations talking about fighting ISIS. And this is before it was bombs away from Moscow. But he said, look, a military effort won't do it in the end. He said, we've got to defeat their ideology. The president said, ideologies are not defeated with guns. They're defeated by better ideas, a more attractive and compelling vision. Roseburg, Oregon today is not an attractive or compelling vision, Jack.
That's for sure. You know, Tom, we can imagine a dystopian future in which schools are like books in Fahrenheit 451 and parents, to escape shooters, send their kids to underground schools. We could move in that direction, or Michael Bloomberg, take note, citizens could assume responsibility for stopping the carnage. Suppose, a thought experiment, Bloomberg targeted two senators, Democrat Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, Republican Jeff Flake of Arizona. Both voted against sane gun laws after Sandy Hook. Heitkamp could be primaried. A few thousand votes could return her to private life. Mark Kelly, Gabriel Giffords' astronaut husband, could be recruited to take on Flake, who is a supposed friend of Gifford. The charge against him, your fellow Arizonan, John McCain, voted for the bill. What's your excuse? You know, you can imagine Bloomberg lavishing millions on public education, town halls, TV ads. Defeat is the only message certain to get through to politicians. Two red state senators beaten on guns. Their fate might just be enough to encourage the others.
Nancy Cordes, do you see points of leverage here in the dismay and grief that follows yet another shooting like this? Do you see? Jack says, well, get in there. Mike Bloomberg's got a lot of money. He's for more gun control, maybe do some targeting. Do you see the leverage, Nancy?
I think that would be one piece of leverage. Another piece would be, of course, if the American people sort of en masse rose up and really pelted their members of Congress with arguments that they should be doing something. There have been groups like A Million Moms for Gun Safety who have tried to increase the pressure, but it hasn't been enough. And so, you know, frankly, it's going to take more than just one or two members of Congress being defeated. I think in the current political situation, you probably would not see a real movement towards gun control unless Democrats controlled the House and the Senate, which appears very unlikely in the near future. One area that there is more bipartisan agreement on is a mental health and the need to really address mental health needs in this country, the acknowledgement that we really haven't done enough to help the mentally ill, to help relatives of the mentally ill so that they can seek treatment when they know that they have a loved one with a problem. But even that really hasn't gone anywhere because it brings up such thorny issues regarding individual freedoms. You know, what do you do if someone's over 18? You know, how can you force them to get treatment if they don't want it? How much would something like that cost? I mean, everyone acknowledges that to really overhaul the nation's mental health system would cost millions, if not billions, of dollars. And, you know, Congress isn't exactly opening its purse these days for massive new domestic projects.
And, so, and if we can't stop these shootings until everybody in America is psychologically calm, I don't know how that works out. Nancy, stand by. Michael Crowley, Jack, let's get to our listeners. Ian in Killeen, Texas. Ian, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Tom.
Hi, what do you think?
Well, I don't think this is a new phenomenon.
Sadly, no.
Something's been going on for a really long time. I think probably since the birth of our nation.
Really? People walking into schools and massacring students?
I think that to be realistic about it, I think guns, weapons have been a part of our nation, our culture for a long time. But I think it's the press, the media, that's picking and choosing what they want to get a hold of. And I don't think that violence here or there is necessarily something that we can look at and say, oh, wait, you know, this is worse than that. And if we're calling it, you know, this crazy psychological phenomenon, I think that it all deserves the same viewpoint or not at all. So,
you mean any killing anywhere? But, okay, I take your point, Ian. But if we've got 45 shootings at schools or colleges in the country so far this year, I mean, what kind of press would it be if it didn't pay attention to that? And when 10 kids are gunned down and one or, you know, nine plus the shooter and seven wounded at one go in Oregon, don't we have to talk about that? Would you just ignore it or what?
It's going on. This is probably something that's been going on in the 80s, 90s. It's something that's currently happening, but I just think that the media is blasting as much as they can. I think there's more important things going on in the world. I think people in the United States, elsewhere, are starving. It's a problem, but I don't think it needs to be addressed all over our public media, and it needs to be the center of attention for everybody.
I'm sympathetic to not wanting to give huge exposure to these shooters. You had the sheriff there in Roseburg not even wanting to name the shooter. I get that, but Jack, the press giving too much attention to these things when you've got, you know, rows of students gunned down?
You know, David Brooks suggested that some time ago, that if the press sort of did omerta and said nothing, these people wouldn't, you know, these kinds of things would die. It doesn't seem likely. I mean, the president made the startling comment, look at the statistics on what we've spent on the number of death by terrorism and death by guns, and the billions, trillions we've spent on the terrorists and what's being done about the guns. Look at that, those numbers, and tell me this isn't a crisis. That's what he said.
I'm looking at a number here of nearly 10,000 killed by guns so far in this year. Another more than 20,000 injured. Those are huge numbers. Yesterday, Roseburg, Oregon. Oh, Jack Beattie, Nancy Cordes with CBS, Michael Crowley with Politico. Please stand by. We're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, massacre in Oregon, Russia bombing in Syria, Planned Parenthood grilled the Pope and Kim Davis, water on Mars. Nancy Cordes is with us, congressional correspondent for CBS News, Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Jack Beattie is here, and you can join us on Oregon and how we stop this, on Russia and Syria. How do you read Vladimir Putin there and his bombing this week? And then lots of politics. What do you make of Donald Trump's tax plan, of Bernie Sanders' strong fundraising in the latest quarter, Ben Carson's the same, and, of course, the grilling of Planned Parenthood before the congressional committee this week. Lots of response to the shootings online here. Third Way says more blood on the hands of the gun lobby and opponents of public mental health programs. Our death tolls and fear levels will rise, but nothing changes. Paul says, wonder where the next one will be. A bunch of other listeners saying, you know, look, Oregon has enacted universal background checks. So, you know, what actually works here? Let's hear from a couple more callers on this front. The whole country just watching, listen to this drumbeat of school shootings. Nicole in Austin, Texas. Nicole, you're on.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm a concerned parent. I feel like most Americans, which is that our gun violence crisis is, you know, is getting worse. We're having a serious public safety crisis, and we're losing our children to our addiction to guns and our lax gun laws. And the caller earlier, my fellow Texan, I just want to say that he was emphasizing a balanced approach. Look, well, we don't need balance. We need solutions, common sense solutions, like closing the loophole on background checks. And, you know, we have a gun homicide rate that's 20 times higher than other developed nations, so it isn't balanced. We are the exception, and we need to fix this.
Nicole, I'm sure a lot of people feel exactly the same way, but where do you see the leverage to do that, Nicole? The president says, what are you, fellow Americans, prepared to do? What do you do?
Well, look, I mean, 90% of Americans support background checks on all gun sales, and I think a lot of people don't realize that we don't have that and support that because it's so sensible, and this includes 78% of Texans. So that's the first thing. Keeping guns out of the wrong hands is the absolute first thing and the minimum standards that we should have. And
Nicole, I appreciate your call. Let's get a couple more. Harrison in Kansas, St. Paul, Kansas. Harrison, you're on.
Hi, Tom. My thought on it is we don't really need more laws. We don't need the gun control per se. I think what we need is kind of like a Fast and Furious program for the teachers. Go out, arm every teacher in America. If they don't want to take it, don't take it.
What do you mean Fast and Furious program? You mean gun training, gun skills training, get them to the shooting range?
Kind of. offer a program where the teacher would not have to pay for their service weapon. But I like the idea of the teachers having the weapons instead of an armed guard. That way the kids aren't seeing that mindset. They're not in that military mindset, per se.
Free guns for teachers and then have them arm up. But, Harrison, I mean, you know, yesterday maybe you're desperate for someone to shoot this guy down, but isn't it kind of sick to think of a country where we have to have a gun on the hip of our teachers?
Well, it is it's a sick thing you have to deal with. But the big thing, Tom, is the criminals are going and they're killing kids. They don't care if the gun they have is legal or not. And they can get those guns from anybody on any street corner in a lot of major cities.
Yeah, a street corner, but also just legally down at the store. And, you know, we keep pumping those guns into our ranks. Harrison, I appreciate your call from Kansas. Detroit, Aaron is on the line. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you think?
I'm befuddled with, as a nation, I think our intelligence must be deluding us. We keep talking about guns. Are we not willing yet to admit that maybe this experiment of this free morality or godless society that we've created might be failing? Maybe it's people that are losing their connection with right and wrong or horror and what's normal, and that's not a gun issue, that's a morality issue. When will somebody start talking about that? The president is right. It is becoming commonplace for us to slaughter each other, and it's not a gun issue.
And yet, the means of slaughtering are so widely available. Look, there's clearly a problem here with this young man, 26-year-old young man, more widely than that, and yet reach out your hand in this country and there's a gun. You know, load it, shoot it, and a lot of people die. Jack, moral fiber.
Well, you know, they have plenty of moral fiber in Europe, and that seems to be enough. But they also have strict gun laws. And, you know, you look at it as a sort of causal issue. What's primary? What's the major difference? Is it lack of moral fiber here? Well, they have it there. Same in Europe. But they don't have the gun profligacy we have. I mean, it does seem pretty primal, that example.
Michael, how about it? Looking at it internationally again, is there some framework of morality that other countries have that is protecting them from this, or is it gun laws?
You know, it's not immediately obvious to me that we have a different moral. Plenty of countries have moral problems in all kinds of other walks of
alienation
life.
And some shootings. I mean, you've got the guy in Norway and all the rest, but nothing like our numbers.
And, you know, and I mean, to the extent that morality and religion might be synonymous in this context, we're a very religious country, more so than a lot of other countries. So it doesn't quite click.
One more call on this, and we've got to go to, we've got much more news, but Ed in Waterloo, Iowa. Ed, thank you for calling. You're on the air. Ed.
Yeah, I'm a police officer in one of the Midwest towns out here, and the biggest, scariest thing is that I've got 13, 14, 15-year-old kids that get their hands on guns. And they don't fight anymore with fists. They shoot at each other. And that's just a small thing that's going on the streets out here right now.
How do you explain that? Where are they getting, where are 13- to 14-year-old kids in Waterloo, Iowa, getting guns?
Well, that's a scary thing. A lot of them are stealing from other houses. They're being brought in from other cities. But when a kid that age can get a gun and they don't fight anymore like they used to,
yeah,
and they just shoot at each other, it's an alarming thing that I think is a small thing that we're missing.
I mean, kids down in the dirt fighting, that's happened forever. But pick up a gun and make it a gunfight, we're into a different rank entirely. The president putting out a challenge, you know, emotional again last night, and understandably, but saying, Americans, look, do something here. This is going to take the whole country to do something here. I'm going to turn globally for a minute here. Guns in the U.S., fighter jets and bombers over Syria. Michael Crowley, we heard from Vladimir Putin this week at the U.N., and then boom, 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 Russian bombs start dropping, start falling. What are they hitting, Michael?
Well, they are hitting all kinds of rebel groups fighting the embattled regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Putin, before the bombing began, suggested that Russia was prepared to lead an international coalition, almost like the one that fought Adolf Hitler in World War II. That was an analogy that he used, specifically against the Islamic State, which is one of several groups in Syria fighting the Assad regime. As it happens, the airstrikes thus far have not primarily focused on the Islamic State. They have focused in areas of the country where other groups are operating, but the Islamic State does not have strongholds. And according to some reports, which the administration has not disputed, some of those strikes have hit rebel forces that we describe as moderate, who have received support from the CIA covertly, which in effect puts us in a kind of proxy war against the Russians. But fundamentally, Putin has sort of advertised this as joining the noble fight against ISIS. In reality, what it looks like he's doing is propping up Bashar Assad, who is a longtime ally of Moscow, against all comers, essentially ensuring that Assad is not toppled, maintaining Russia's influence in Syria, which dates back to the Cold War. There is a important Russian military base on the Mediterranean coast there, and generally driving the Obama administration a little crazy. The bombing began less than 48 hours after Putin had sat down with President Obama, who grudgingly agreed to this meeting at the United Nations, and gave no notice to President Obama that this was about to happen, nor did the foreign minister give notice to Secretary of State John Kerry, with whom he had been having regular consultations up in New York. Everyone, of course, is there for the United Nations General Assembly gathering.
And then the U.S. got, so what, 1 hour material warning before the bombs began, and the Russians said, clear the airspace over Syria, we're going to start bombing in 1 hour, boom.
Evidently, with a knock on the door at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, where some, I think, a Russian military attaché showed up and said, I have something to tell you, which Defense Secretary Ashton Carter called unprofessional. You know, there are two things going on here. One is the incredibly tangled, chaotic, horrible mess of the situation on the ground in Syria. The other is this kind of psychological warfare that Moscow seems to be waging against Washington, trying to knock Obama off balance, embarrass him, make him look weak, confuse America, and demonstrate to the world America is weak in the Middle East, weak on the globe. Russia is reasserting itself globally and in the Middle East and has the initiative. And I think, you know, on that latter side, the kind of propaganda psychological component has been pretty effective. But the last thing I'll say is that I think there are officials in the Obama administration who are kind of saying to Putin, good luck with that. Syria is a quagmire, and to some degree, you're welcome to get more deeply involved. You're probably going to regret it.
Maybe they'll regret it, but this week it looked so right in the face of the United States, not really going after ISIS, but going after, well, anyone who would help them defend Assad, including CIA-backed rebels there. Here was Putin. This was on Monday, his first address to the UN in 10 years, defending his support, Russia's support of the Syrian government, criticizing other Western states' policies in the Middle East, talking here through an interpreter.
We think it is an enormous mistake to refuse to cooperate with the Syrian government and its armed forces who are violently fighting terrorism face to face. We should finally acknowledge that no one but President Assad's armed forces and Kurds' militia are truly fighting the Islamic State and other terrorist organizations in Syria.
Washington audibly kind of spinning here, trying to figure out how to deal with this new initiative out of Moscow. President Obama is telling the UN Assembly in New York on Monday that the U.S. would cooperate, even with Russia. He named them, but said we can't go back to the pre-war status quo. Of course, that is Assad's rule. That's Assad's government, which Russia now appears to be defending, fighting for. Here's Obama on Monday at the UN.
The United States is prepared to work with any nation, including Russia and Iran, to resolve the conflict. But we must recognize that there cannot be, after so much bloodshed, so much carnage, a return to the pre-war status quo.
Nancy Cordes, what's the response you're hearing on Capitol Hill to this very fast-paced turn of events in Syria?
Well, there seems to be bipartisan agreement, Tom, that we don't want to get into a conflict with Russia in Syria or anywhere else, and therefore we should sort of back off for now on the idea of trying to topple Assad, both because, you know, that makes things that really sort of heats up our conflict with Russia, but also because there's no obvious successor for Assad. If he falls, what happens then? There's an enormous power vacuum. And on 60 Minutes last weekend, Putin argued to Charlie Rose, hey, look what happened when you went to war in Iraq. You didn't like Hussein. You toppled him. And then what? You had no plan for who could succeed him, who would have the strength to succeed him and hold the country together. And look what you ended up with. And that led to the rise of ISIS. And so that is an argument that does make some sense to people on Capitol Hill. And so they're basically, you know, on the right and the left saying to the president, hey, let's not necessarily, you know, get on Russia's side here, but let's focus on ISIS. That's really our key fight right now. Those are the people who are killing Americans, killing our allies. We need to focus on them. At the same time, there is much more of a divide over what to do about Syrian refugees, because the president has announced that he's going to increase the number of refugees that are being brought here to the United States every year. And there was a hearing on Capitol Hill today, this week, where, you know, you really saw in very stark relief the differences in opinion about that. Republicans saying, how are we going to screen these people? How do we know that they're not people who want to do harm to Americans? And Democrats saying, you know, we've gotten much better at this process. We know how to screen these people, and they're not coming here for any other reason than just to escape the bloodshed in their own country.
I mean, all fair, but it can look this week like the U.S. is just kind of sidelined, and Russia calling the tune. We've been told for decades this is a critical region. Who's driving the boat here? Nick in Ames, Iowa. Nick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, it's really, I'm really incredulous at what has happened recently and how Obama's seemingly no plan in Syria has. I mean, what was the only thing that could, how could it get worse? And, the you know, Syria, Assad's killing his own people. We have millions of refugees coming out of Syria. And Obama's no plan has resulted in Putin getting in it. And now Putin, you know, supporting this terrible dictator. And it's frustrating to me that I think the gentleman who was talking earlier about the psychological propaganda, it's working on me.
And it's confusing.
I think that's interesting. The only way it could get worse is what has happened, because Obama has continued to do nothing in Syria, as far as I can tell, nothing significant. And now we have Putin in bed with this terrible man, you know, these images coming out of the torture of his own people.
Barrel bombs and all the rest, and those streams, the rivers of people headed out of Syria. Nick, I appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, what do you see unfolding here?
Well, the question is, you know, who lost Syria? Everybody's an expert on what did not happen. And you hear this. If only Obama's maxim were not don't do stupid stuff, we could have done stupid stuff like arming ISIS, the likely result of putting weapons earlier into the hands of Syrian rebels. We could have killed Iranian advisors to the Syrian army and thereby jeopardized the Iran nuke deal, a likely result of establishing a no-fly zone. Obama could have bombed Assad for using chemical weapons without going to Congress, but that would have strained the U.S. constitutional system. Stupid stuff, all of it. You know, don't do stupid stuff is an improvement on the formula of error punctuated by disaster that's driven U.S. foreign policy for decades. But Hillary Clinton is right. It doesn't sound noble. So let's class it up by summoning the shade of John Quincy Adams, quote, America does not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher of the freedom and independence of all. She is the champion and vindicator only of her own. That's don't do stupid stuff.
So what does that mean, Jack? Just stand aside, let Putin come in, whatever, like bring on the deluge. Whatever happens in the Middle East, we're busy at home with school shootings.
Well, The question is, what are our vital interests in Syria? And it seems to me that the president has had the right focus in saying that our primary interest was a nuclear deal with Iran that could have been jeopardized by a forward policy in Syria.
How about the unity of Europe, now threatened by this flow of refugees, putting all that pressure on the EU? It seems like there are plenty of U.S. interests that ultimately intersect with Syria.
Yes, but that's assuming that somehow a larger intervention would have stemmed that flow. Perhaps a no-fly zone, but there were risks on the other side.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, water on Mars. NASA announced the discovery this week. Perfect timing for Matt Damon and his new film, The Martian. NASA first, then the film.
Liquid water has been found on Mars.
Woo! In your face, Neil Armstrong.
We left him behind. Let's go get our boy.
Real in Hollywood meeting right there. Trevor Noah took over as host of The Daily Show.
Also, why didn't they get an American to host? And again, Comedy Central tried, and those people also declined. And so once more, a job Americans rejected is now being done by an immigrant.
And legendary jazz saxophonist Phil Woods has died at 83, a big figure in bebop with a memorable solo in pop on Billy Joel's 1977, Just the Way You Are.
I love you just the way.
Seems like a long time ago. We're looking at a week in the news. Massacre in Oregon. Russia bombs in Syria. Planned Parenthood grilled the Pope and Kim Davis. Water on Mars. Nancy Cordes is with us, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Michael Crowley is here, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Jack Beatty is here. You can join us. What did you think of the Planned Parenthood hearings? Were you surprised at the news of the Pope meeting Kim Davis? Elated? Outraged? What do you think of Donald Trump's tax plan, of Bernie Sanders' strong fundraising, of Ben Carson's same? How about Kevin McCarthy? Did he show the Republican hand on the Benghazi hearings designed, he suggested this week, to hurt Hillary? Are you following Edward Snowden on Twitter? Are you ready to settle on Mars? Of course, outrage over Planned Parenthood has gone on for months now. Highly, highly political Planned Parenthood, saying the whole video gave the wrong impression of what's going on, but it's been picked up and the big time. And the CEO, Cecile Richards, was before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Here's a little bit where Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio went after the controversial underground videos made by anti-abortion activists.
Everyone has agreed they were heavily edited, and that certainly I think even the perpetrator.
My question is, why did you apologize?
Agreed, perpetrator has agreed they were done undercover. I spoke with Dr. Nukatola, who was featured in one of the videos, and I thought it was important. In my opinion, it was inappropriate to have a clinical discussion of. In a non-confidential, non-clinical setting.
Nancy Cordes, what did you make ultimately of this hearing on Planned Parenthood, the grilling there, Cecile Richards' response in hours of testimony?
Yeah, 5 hours of very, very intense grilling. You know, Republicans essentially tried to make 2 points. Number one, that Planned Parenthood doesn't deserve federal funding because there are other community health centers out there that can also provide services for women, but that don't perform abortions, which is something that they oppose. And also that Planned Parenthood has plenty of money as it is because it gets big donations and its executives, including Cecile Richards, make good money and they take a lot of trips and they have a lot of fundraising parties, and therefore the federal government shouldn't be giving them any money. That those were basically their two main arguments. What Richards argued and what Democrats argued is, look, 80% of the money that that Planned Parenthood gets every year from the federal government comes in the form of reimbursements for Medicaid patients who come to Planned Parenthood to get all kinds of health mm-hmm. services. And so this is not some handout that they're getting from the federal government. This is money that, just like any health center, any hospital that sees Medicaid patients, they get reimbursed. And so why should Planned Parenthood somehow perform these same services for free? And furthermore, what they argued is that in a lot of places, there aren't alternatives. There aren't community health services that can take some of these patients if Planned Parenthood were to go away or were to stop seeing Medicaid patients. At the end of the day, it's a sort of a pointless debate because Planned Parenthood will continue to get its funding. The votes don't exist, despite a lot of Republican passion on this issue, to defund Planned Parenthood altogether. We saw this week that the government will continue to be funded, and that Planned Parenthood funding will stay intact. But a lot of bad feelings on both sides after that hearing.
A continuing resolution this week that means the government will be funded. That will go on. But in December, the funding becomes an issue again. Are you saying the Planned Parenthood issue is dead despite pledges by many Republicans to keep it going, to try again to defund in December?
I'm not saying it's dead, but I think we've seen before that Congress has a short attention span. And so it could come back as an issue in December, or we could be on to something else. We could be on to a totally different funding fight over some other program, in which case Planned Parenthood would kind of go by the wayside. The reason suddenly that Planned Parenthood funding became such a central issue is because of those videos. And so the question is, will those videos still be top of mind come December? Where will all these congressional investigations that are now taking place, a new committee most likely being set up in the House to look into those videos, will those sort of peter out, or will they still be going strong when we get to the next funding fight?
Lloyd in Charleston, South Carolina. Lloyd, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I just watched the congressional hearings with Planned Parenthood. They just practically destroyed her. And I agree completely, but they were really tough on her. But the $450 million they have without the government giving them any money, which is what they should not do. I just listened to the videographer on TV last night, the person who did the videos of the fetuses. And he was grilled by Chris Cuomo, who is an attorney. And he just kept saying that he didn't give any straight answer to anything. He was very sharp. But the fact is that I really do think that somebody ought to talk about to you, because I'm not as expert on it as I...
About what, Lloyd?
About the fact that there should not be any more money given by the government to Planned Parenthood.
Lloyd, we've got it. I mean, you saw the CEO there. It was long, it was tough, and it was very fraught, emotional kind of questioning. Her point was, and you heard her say there, look, people spoke about this in a way that she wasn't happy about, but that the activity itself is legal and that Planned Parenthood's done nothing wrong, that it was misrepresented in the film. And so there you are. It seems still to be driven by opposition to abortion, which, of course, Planned Parenthood does some of. But her point is we do a lot of things. And where the votes line up, Nancy Cordes says the votes aren't there to stop it. And she says, well, it's not illegal anyway. But, Lloyd, I got your point. Ernest in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Ernest, you're on.
Hi. Thanks, Tom. I just wanted to say one thing that nobody's really touched up on is on abortion is the fact that no government should force women to stay pregnant if they don't want to. And I'm surprised a lot of politicians or news coverage has not said that or in those words exactly. But
well, I mean, our Supreme Court has essentially said that. That is the law of the land right now. There's, as you know, there's a lot of opposition to abortion.
Yeah, definitely. But the the case is that nobody should force a woman to stay pregnant if they choose not to, and it's against any moral standings. I believe that, you know, if I was a girl, I wouldn't want to be, and if I got pregnant, I didn't want to be, I would want that option.
You and a lot of others, Ernest, opposition there at the same time. Jack Beatty, opponents of abortion handed a big, very hot tool with this video. And where do you see this going?
Well, you know, the chairman, Jason Chaffetz, he displayed a courtroom-like chart, and he claimed it showed that the number of abortions performed by Planned Parenthood in 2013 surpassed the number of its other health services. Alas, for truth and reputation, the numbers in small print were 327,000 abortions and 935 cancer screenings. But, you know, the Republicans did raise a point that goes to an issue that Lloyd raised. They were outraged that Planned Parenthood's political arm spends millions backing Democrats. And the Center for Responsive Politics says that Planned Parenthood is to the Democrats what the National Rifle Association is to the Republicans. Well, that's not exactly right, and the Republicans point out. Taxpayers don't subsidize the NRA by $500 million a year. And Republicans are saying, you know, we're right to question the propriety of a subsidy to a group that shares it with the Democrats.
But what are they supposed to do? I mean, I take your point. It is kind of weird to have government money coming in and then supporting politics. On the other hand, one of their core activities is under strong political attack. If the balance in Congress changed from what Nancy Cordes points out today, they could be shut down. So.
Yes, indeed, and sure. And then and Planned Parenthood says we're right to be able to defend ourselves. If we don't lobby, you're gonna take away our subsidy.
And of course, they say this film misrepresents what we do. Matt in Providence, Rhode Island. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I wanted to call and comment about the entire situation seems to be blown out of proportion with the way this video is a clear misrepresentation of their practices and what they do. It was some individuals who were not speaking about the subject matter the way they should have, and it's being misrepresented by these videos, and I think it's terrible for an organization that does a lot of good for a lot of women and people in this country.
Matt, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. I want to get to the Pope and Kim Davis. Kind of tangential here, but they had this interesting thing where nobody knew while the Pope was in the United States, at least not publicly, but on the flight back to Rome on Monday, there was this question put to the Pope by a reporter. Do you support individuals, including government officials, who often say they can't in good conscience abide by some laws or discharge their duties as government officials, for example, when issuing marriage licenses? Didn't name Kim Davis, but raised her circumstance, and the Pope responded.
Ma si posso dire che l'oggezione di coscienza
on the plane headed home after quite a visit, he says, yes, I can say the conscientious objection is a right that is a part of every human right. It's a right, and if a person does not allow others to be conscientious objector, he denies a right. And the next thing is kind of mystifying at that moment. Next thing you know, here's Kim Davis on ABC News, Kentucky County Clerk, who refused to issue those licenses for gay marriage, saying that she had met Pope Francis in Washington.
He told me before he left, he said, stay strong. That was a great encouragement. Just knowing that the Pope is on track, you know, with what we're doing and agreeing, you know, kind of validates everything.
Kim Davis claiming everything validated in a meeting with the Pope. Nancy Cordes, is it clear that Pope Francis knew who he was meeting with? Or who arranged this meeting? Was this all crystal clear? And the Vatican has now put out a statement saying that this was not an endorsement of Kim Davis's views. You get reports that the Pope was snookered into this meeting somehow. Do we know what happened here?
Well, you know, the Vatican is being a little bit cagey about this. And when they've been asked about whether this meeting actually took place, they said, well, we can't confirm it, but we can't deny it. And, you know, if you want to take that as an indication that this meeting took place, well, then you might not be wrong about it. So, you know, it's not.
But it did take place, right? That's no longer ambiguous.
It did take place, but they're not, you know, they're not coming out sort of wholeheartedly and saying, yes, the Pope wanted to meet her for this reason, and that's why they met, and this is how it came about. You know, it does appear that she was invited to come to Washington and meet with him. You know, I I don't think she would have come on a whim, hoping that perhaps, you know, the Pope's schedule might open up.
But there are a lot of politics in there, presumably even right around the Pope. I mean, E.G. Dionne saying that this was brokered by Archbishop Carlo Vigano, a papal nuncio to the U.S., who's close to Pope Benedict. I mean, Michael Crowley, how does this look to you? Is this Vatican politics? Are these people who aren't on the Pope's team? Or is the Pope, is this what, you know, he really believes? Yes, Kim Davis, deny these things and I'm with you.
Well, I think if he was more wholeheartedly behind her cause, we wouldn't have seen the statement that's come out today that's put some distance between them. And, you know, I don't know the granular details here, but I do suspect the Pope came through the country and probably had brief, you know, 5 to 20 second audiences with about 5,000
people. Yeah.
All kinds of strings were pulled, phone calls made. Can I just get in and shake his hand? You know, this is such an important member of our community. And at some point, you maybe get a little overwhelmed, deluged. He probably had no idea who about half these people were. He probably wouldn't have been thrilled to see all of them. I'm not trying to make excuses for him.
Well,
but
given that statement,
that's my guess.
I can let the Vatican speak for itself here. The Vatican spokesman today saying the Pope did not enter into the details of the situation of Mrs. Davis, and his meeting with her should not be considered a form of support of her position in all of its particular and complex aspects. So the sort of standing back here, Jack Beatty, for a minute, it looked sort of like the Pope's version of Netanyahu before Congress here, wading right into the Kim Davis business.
It sure did. And as Michael Sean Winters writes in the National Catholic Reporter, Kim Davis is not a poster person for conscientious objection. He writes, she was not jailed for practicing her religion. She was jailed for forcing others to practice her religion. And so it's just a terrible example, really, of what is a valid point, you know, religious conscientious objection to law. People should be able to say, I don't want to follow laws that I don't agree with, if they're not public officials. And of course, the classic case seems to be for the church, the caterer to a gay wedding and so on. But the church has been kind of blithe about this. Winters quotes a Jesuit who was with the Pope saying, not to put too fine a point on it, but Pope Francis met with Mark Wahlberg, and that does not mean he liked Ted. Hey, that's a pretty
movie Ted.
Way.
Hey,
yeah.
Fundraising numbers out this week. Bernie Sanders right up next to Hillary Clinton, $26 million to her $28 million. Ben Carson with strong fundraising numbers. Nancy, this is still a wild primary season, almost.
It is when you think about the juggernaut that is the Clinton fundraising machine and the fact that she hits several big-time fundraisers every week where she raises the maximum $2,700 per person. Then you've got Bernie Sanders, who says he doesn't even do big-money fundraisers and who says that his average donation over the past 3 months was $30.
Clinton won't say what her
average was. So
the
fact that he was able to get so close to her is amazing.
Bernie Sanders on a roll in fundraising and maybe more this week. Hillary Clinton out there doing her thing. Ben Carson and a lot more, too. What a week. Too much in some ways, but there's the news. Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Thank you for working through all of it with us, Nancy. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Crowley at Politico, you're great. Thank you for joining us today.
You're great, too, Tom. Thanks so much.
Jack Beatty, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
This is On Point.